Hello there. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the so-called Trump of the Tropics visits the White House. President Trump continues to attack the late Senator John McCain.
I think that's disgraceful. Plus, there are other things. I was never a fan of John McCain, and I never will be.
The U.S. Supreme Court hands the Trump administration an immigration win. Also ahead, big names to headline the 50th anniversary of a groundbreaking music festival. It's all on today's International Edition. Brazil's new president, dubbed the Trump of the Tropics, met with President Donald Trump at the White House on Tuesday. The leaders discussed a range of trade and military issues, including trying to find a resolution to the political crisis in Venezuela. White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara has this report.
Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, chose the White House for his first foreign visit since taking office. He campaigned on building closer ties with the U.S., blasts what he calls fake news, and uses rhetoric such as Brazil first. His moniker, Trump of the Tropics.
Afinal, it is fair to say that today Brazil does have a president who is not anti-American.
The two leaders discussed a range of issues, including finding a resolution to the crisis in Venezuela.
We can do the tough sanctions, and all options are open, so we may be doing that. But we haven't done the toughest of sanctions, as you know. We've done, right down the middle. But we can go a lot tougher if we need to do that.
Bolsonaro declined to answer whether he would support a U.S. military intervention to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
Everything that we discussed here will be honored. But unfortunately, certain pieces of information, if they are to come to the table, may not be debated publicly.
Brazil could play a stabilizing role in a transitional post-Maduro environment, says Roger Noriega of the American Enterprise Institute.
Brazil could, with a very professional military, play that kind of role. But I think in terms of an intervention or the U.S. Going in proactively to oust Maduro, I don't think the U.S.'s military is there, and neither is the Brazilian military quite yet.
Trump floated the idea of bringing Brazil into NATO, the military alliance between North America and Europe, or at least as a major non-NATO ally, with preferential access to buy American military technology.
I think it's a very important step in terms of priming the pump of that cooperation on national security issues. I don't think that the Brazilians are quite completely aligned with us on the use of force, for example, in Venezuela, where the President of the United States has said all options are on the table. But I think that their outlook is similar.
As part of increased military cooperation, in September, Brazil allowed the use of its Alcantara aerospace base to launch American rockets. Trump promised support for Brazil to join the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which includes most of the world's developed economies. Both leaders are seeking to expand bilateral trade relations. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
President Trump is facing criticism for insulting the late John McCain on Twitter, but he says he's not backing down. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The president was criticized for tweeting insults at McCain over the weekend, but says he's not backing off.
I was never a fan of John McCain, and I never will be.
Blasting McCain for voting against repealing the Obama health care law nearly 2 years ago.
I think that's disgraceful. Plus, there are other things.
Meghan McCain responded to the president's insults yesterday on ABC's The View.
He spends his weekend obsessing over great men. Because he knows it, and I know it, and all of you know it, he will never be a great man.
She says her father was the president's kryptonite in life and now in death. Sagar Magani at the White House.
And joining us now is someone who knew John McCain well, former campaign aide to the late U.S. Senator Rob Cohen. Rob, what would Senator McCain say? How would he react to the president's attacks if he were still here?
No, our motto on the campaign was country first. He would not care about the personal attacks at all. What he would really care about is what Trump is doing to the country. John McCain was very concerned about the rise of Russian influence, Vladimir Putin, etc., national debt. foreign policy mistakes, disrupting our alliances. That's the thing, John. And then the coarsening of our politics. John McCain like used to say, we're political opponents, but we're not enemies. We have real enemies over there, and we shouldn't be enemies here at home.
What went through your mind, given that, A, you know, this was a decorated war hero who hasn't even been gone for a year, and also just in general that this is the office of the president. This is a leader of the most powerful country in the world.
Completely unsurprised. This is the guy who said, I like people that weren't captured. Anybody who says that is a phony patriot and nothing else. These two factions in the Republican Party have been here since the time of Teddy Roosevelt. Again, we talk about this in our podcast episode, the really patriotic ones against the ones that, let's just say, are a little bit more self-interested. What Trump first got upset about was the dossier, and because McCain was the one who delivered it to the FBI, you know, I suspect something big is happening with that dossier, and Trump's upset, and he's trying to discredit it ahead of time. Unfortunately, it's not going to work, because John McCain has more heroism on his gravestone than Trump could ever have in anything he's ever done.
You know, and people are talking about how this is unprecedented, but you actually talk about how it isn't. This has happened in our country's history with this sort of dispute.
The Republican Party has for a long time struggled with this, the moderates versus the conservatives versus the really toxic members of their party. You know, there was the segregationists, George Wallace, who left the Democrats because they had decided they were going to be too kind to the middle. And then back before World War II, there were the isolationists as well. There were members who supported really toxic parts of our country. And during Teddy Roosevelt's time, you know, his own party didn't even want him to be president. They was worried they would not be able to control him and pursue their corruption. So they tried to bury him in the vice presidency. The only reason we got Teddy Roosevelt as president is because William McKinley was shot by an anarchist because security wasn't so good back then. And then Teddy Roosevelt tries to push all these anti-corruption measures and the square deal for the American people with antitrust, and his own party blocked him. It was only after certain things changed, which we talk about in our podcast episode as Guide to How Mavericks Can Start Winning Again, that Teddy Roosevelt was able to win. But this has been going on for over 100 years.
Of course, we didn't have Twitter back then.
That was one difference today, a big one, probably. I would say back then that the news media was very polluted with a bunch of garbage. There was so-called yellow journalism that was just sensational. But one of the big differences was there were a few investigative journalism outlets that were really legitimate, put in the hard work to deconstruct the really weird, complex things that were screwing over the average American, namely the big power of the monopoly. And these are what gave public opinion the boost that Teddy Roosevelt needed to get his reforms over the edge. And today, our investigative journalism just isn't the same, and it's, in fact, overshadowed by the cacophony of Twitter, et cetera.
What do you think John McCain would say about how his daughter is so righteously publicly defending him?
John McCain was always very careful to say he's proud of his daughter, and he would never criticize his daughter. He's never said anything to me negative about his daughter. So I think he'd be very proud that she is standing up for the McCain family, for patriotism, for country first. Personally, as a McCain fan, I'd like to see her attack Trump and take on Trump, not only when Trump attacks her family, but also when he attacks so many things about the country that make us great, like the FBI or NATO. I'd wish she'd do more of that, but at least I'm pleased to see her doing what she's done this weekend.
Are you surprised that we aren't really hearing Republicans coming out standing up for their colleague John McCain? How surprised are you that no one's saying anything?
I'm devastated, especially Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham was his best friend. I thought Lindsey Graham would be the next John McCain. I am heartbroken by the way Lindsey Graham is behaving. I am less surprised by the other Republicans. You know, I'd love to see some of these guys stand up more. They could, and I wish they would.
All right, that's Rob Cohen, former campaign aide to the late U.S. Senator John McCain. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. New Zealand's prime minister is vowing to never speak the name of the accused mosque gunman. Kazakhstan's president has abruptly resigned after nearly 30 years in office. U.S.-backed forces say it has control of ISIS in a Syria encampment. And a Mexican man dies in U.S. border agency custody. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. On our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday endorsed the U.S. government authority to detain immigrants awaiting deportation any time, potentially even years after they've completed prison terms for criminal convictions, handing President Donald Trump a victory as he pursues hardline immigration policies. The court issued ruled 5-4 with its conservative justices in the majority and its liberal justices dissenting that federal authorities could pick up such immigrants and place them into indefinite detention at any time, not just immediately after they finish their prison sentences. Joining us to discuss all of this is attorney Ben Foyer, chairman of the California Appellate Law Group. Thank you for being with us. So what does this mean for undocumented immigrants in the U.S. going forward?
What the Trump administration has been doing as part of its efforts to increase immigration enforcement is it's been going back around to folks who may, for example, have a green card in the United States, were convicted of one of these crimes 5, 7, 10 or more years ago, released, and they've kind of been out and living their lives and perhaps with a job, you know, largely paid their debt to society, at least they thought. And then the Trump administration has been kind of going back around finding these folks and arresting them pursuant to this rule that allows, the statute that allows these folks to be deported. And not only is it arresting them, but it's not allowing them to have any access to a bond or have the ability to challenge the conditions of their confinement, at least until they eventually get a hearing before an immigration judge, which could be months and months away. So the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in San Francisco, last year said, hey, look, it's one thing if the government arrests people immediately after they're released from local or state prison for these crimes and puts them in this immigration confinement, then it's clear that the statute says that they're not entitled to a bond. But if you're waiting years and years after they're released and then going and just kind of grabbing them and saying that you have no ability to challenge your situation, you have to give these people a bond hearing in, you know, a reasonable period of time. And today the Supreme Court reversed and said, no, under the statute that Congress passed and the president signed, it doesn't matter whether the federal authorities grab you in right immediately after you're released from state prison or grab you sometime later, years later, and put you in kind of immigration lockup. You've been convicted of or pleaded guilty to a very serious crime at some point, and the statute says they can take you away. And not only that, you don't get a right to a bond hearing.
What does this mean for immigrants going forward?
What it means is that immigrants anywhere in the United States who have been convicted of a serious offense could may be taken by immigration authorities at any time, put in kind of a pre-deportation lockup, and not given a right to have a bond hearing or necessarily challenge the conditions of their confinement at that stage. The reality is that this is the law as it exists everywhere in the country other than the Ninth Circuit, and was the law in the Ninth Circuit up until this ruling last year. So it doesn't really change the situation for immigrants, at least legally. The difference is that the Trump administration is now enforcing this law against immigrants who it's the government basically left alone after they were released from state and local prison. So people who have gone on with their lives, perhaps they were rehabilitated and are working, they have families, they may be in school, and all of a sudden the government comes up and says, hey, you know, 10 years ago you were convicted of a serious crime, we're going to put you in lockup, and you're going to be there for months and months while you wait for an immigration hearing, and there's nothing you can do.
All right, that's attorney Ben Foyer, chairman of the California Appellate Law Group. People in New Zealand say they have completed police say they've completed autopsies on all 50 victims in last week's mosque shootings and have formally identified 12 of them. Six of the identified victims have been returned to their families 4 days after the attack. Relatives were anxiously waiting Tuesday for word when they could bury their loved ones. Islamic tradition calls for bodies to be cleansed and buried as soon as possible after death. Mass shootings and violent crime are rare in New Zealand, a country of nearly 5 million people. However, the man who allegedly carried out the attack is from Australia and has reportedly traveled the world, possibly seeking other white supremacists. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Errol Suthers, a professor of national and homeland security at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He asked Suthers if white supremacy is something more than a fringe movement.
I don't think it's any longer a fringe movement. It is certainly coming of age. It is being globalized at a very rapid pace. And unfortunately, it's getting quite a bit of traction, as we've seen most recently this past weekend.
What is leading to this?
I think what's happening is a number of things. First, you have this issue of immigration and this notion that there's a ticking clock down to the eventual, what these extremists will call white genocide of their respective communities in nations around the world. That is one issue. The other issue is one of believing that there's no longer a place for white people. And unfortunately, this is an international threat that knows no borders, and they believe that the only way to combat this is now violence.
Hasn't this been around for decades?
Yes, it has. But it's taken on a whole new tone and a whole new meaning. Number of events that have happened here in the last several years, and as you know, we don't prosecute for terrorism in the United States unless it involves a foreign ideology or a foreign country, which means there's a huge difference between a person who engages in violence up to and including murder if they're a jihadist, as opposed to if they are someone from another racial or religious or issue-oriented extremist ideology. And so although it's been around for years, this activity now has been somewhat normalized. There have been apologists for things that have happened in the last couple of years. And unfortunately, what we see here when it involves a non-jihadist are notions that there's mental health issues involving the attacker and or the lack of any radicalization to an extremist ideology at all, almost being an apologist for the activity.
How organized is this?
That's probably, if there's a silver lining, the good news. When Charlottesville had the rally 2 years ago in 2017, it was a really interesting seminal event that brought together a number of diverse organizations and ideologies, the Ku Klux Klan, League of the South, the alt-right, a whole collection of organizations that typically don't play well together. But they galvanized that day, and they all were there for a common belief, and unfortunately things went very terribly bad for them. The good news is that that event has led them to splinter again. It hasn't reduced the number of incidents we've had in the country, but at least they don't seem to be working in an organized manner. So it doesn't seem to be an organized effort in terms of groups working together. But they do agree on a couple of things, and that being white supremacy, that being white genocide, that being the fact that immigration is a problem and the cause of the problem here, and that white people no longer have a place. So they do all agree on that, but they don't necessarily agree on how it's going to be achieved.
How and why has it spread to places like New Zealand, which is not accustomed to violence?
Well, I think that the manifesto speaks for itself. The fact that the shooter decided to mention things that are happening here in the United States, decided to mention the President of the United States. This is a globalized effort, and people around the world are following what's happening here in the United States. We are the epicenter of the world for most things, and we're now the epicenter of the world in terms of how white identity is being seen. And I think that may answer the question with regards to how it's spreading and why people are engaging.
How dangerous is this and what's being done about it, and is it enough?
Needless to say, when you've got the FBI saying that 2 years ago, white nationalism is the greatest threat to this country, a greater threat or an equal threat to ISIS, when you've got white nationalists and neo-Nazi movements outpacing ISIS on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and other networks, they're outpacing ISIS on those networks. When you see these things happening at this pace and it doesn't seem to be slowing down, we don't have an administration that wants to embrace it, it's leading to what could be a very, very disastrous time for our country going forward.
All right, that's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Errol Suthers, professor of national and homeland security at the University of Southern California. Different story. You're listening to International Edition on VOA. The United Nations says countries around the world are laying the groundwork to initiate policy changes to tackle a growing global crisis of plastic pollution. At a recent major UN meeting on the environment in Nairobi, member states agreed to cut single-use plastics by 2030. VOA's Ruben Kiama reports.
After 5 days of talks in the Kenyan capital, environment ministers from more than 170 countries delivered a bold blueprint for change. Siim Kiisler is Estonia's environment minister and president of the 4th UN Environment Assembly.
I believe that this is the most ambitious declaration from UNEA, and there will be good results to build on. On single-use plastics products, as far as I know, it's the first universal commitment. So I am really happy for this.
He says the world is at a crossroads, but countries have decided to do things differently, from reducing dependence on single-use plastics to placing sustainability at the heart of future development. The ministers pledged to address environmental challenges with innovative solutions.
We need international commitments because waste disposal, marine littering, transboundary impact of lacking of sound waste management systems. It's an international problem. It cannot be dealt domestically. I hope that every minister, when they go back home, they don't forget about the commitment made here.
Some 4,700 delegates, including environment ministers, scientists, academics, business leaders and environmental campaigners, met in Nairobi on 11th through 15th of March for the UN Assembly, the world's top environmental body whose decisions will set the global agenda, notably ahead of the UN Climate Action Summit in September. Joyce Msuya is the UN Environment's Acting Executive Director.
Finding common ground is not simple. It's the product of cooperation, conversations, and compromise. The climate is warming, species are going extinct, natural resources are being wasted, and many of our ecosystems are under enormous stress.
As evidence mounts of the devastating effects of human activity on the health of the planet, a global clamor for swift action is rising. But campaigners said government's commitment on curbing plastic failed to urgently confront the ever-growing pollution crisis threatening the world's waterways, ecosystems, and health. Outside the UN complex, hundreds of students took to the streets as part of a global protest movement to pressure governments to act. Rebecca Freitag, a youth delegate from Germany, supported the protest call.
An issue that my generation is very much worried about is the plastic pollution. We have plastics everywhere. 80% of the plastic goes into the environment and will stay there forever. And we have to clean up this mess. So I want to see resolutions that are very ambitious and that do not only talk about waste management, but that rather take waste reduction as a priority. We have to redesign our future.
Campaigners at the meeting accused the United States of watering down earlier proposals backed by the European Union that urged governments to phase out single-use plastic products by 2025. Riley Walters, a student at Lehigh University in the United States, took part at the conference.
You know, especially in the United States, recent government, they've sort of been retracting a lot of previous environmental legislation, basically making it worse, taking away protections, like basically for the sake of economic profit, which I think is really unfortunate. And a lot of times, These big companies really influence our government a lot, and these are the companies that are polluting, and so they're able to influence our legislation to be anti-environment.
A key focus of the meeting was protecting oceans and fragile ecosystems. Ministers adopted a number of resolutions on marine plastic litter and microplastics. Experts say an average of 8 million tons of plastic waste ends up in the world's ocean every year. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On our your voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Jay-Z, Dead & Company, and The Killers will be headlining one of the 50th anniversary shows commemorating the groundbreaking Woodstock Festival this year. Woodstock co-founder Michael Lane announced Tuesday that Miley Cyrus, Santana, Imagine Dragons, Robert Plant, The Keys, Chance the Rapper, and more will also play at Woodstock 50, which will take place August 16th through 18th in Watkins Glen, New York, about 185 kilometers northwest of the original site. The event is separate from an anniversary concert planned at the site of the original festival in 1969. Lang made the announcement at a press conference at Jimi Hendrix's Electric Lady Studios in New York City, alongside Common and John Fogerty, who performed at the original Woodstock. Both Fogerty and Common will be performing this summer as well. More than 80 artists are expected on three main stages at Watkins Glen International Racetrack for Woodstock 50. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is